right now we're working, this is one site. We're not, this isn't a commune here. Like, we have, right now we're working with about six different sites where we're building, making gardens, and working with other people. So this is the first year we're doing this. Ideally, like, we don't have a refrigerator. We don't have, there's no refrigerator on this.
We don't have a freezer either.
Yeah, we don't have a freezer, you know. So the people who are working with us, kind of what I was trying to reference before, is we're working with a model that tries to, a metaphor Frank uses a lot is we're trying to climb down the ladder, but also creating rungs for other people to do the same thing.
Good afternoon. This is The Work Show on 90.7 WGXC FM out of Acre, Catskill, and Hudson, New York. And my name is Paul Smart. This month we headed into the lush lands surrounding the Catterskill Creek to meet with the folks at Long Spoon Collective, located on a farm with deep alternative roots in the area. There, Chase Randall and Frank X. O'Leary spoke about their theories regarding truly sustainable work and living and how they've progressed their moneyless ideal of life from the building of tiny houses to the creation of a major new farming enterprise with bigger plans now unfolding, all part of shifting the paradigm, as they say, into something more lasting than what we see us all living and working otherwise. WGXC host Harry Matthew joined us for early morning breakfast and discussion in the fields.
Group living here for a while, and They tried a lot of different things. They had a CSA at one point. They're doing a moneyless and fossil fuel-free month. So,
oh, that's nice.
They're trying to live off the garden mostly. And
how's that going?
Bike everywhere. It's going well. I mean, people... Originally, we were going to do a... we were going to try to do a totally local challenge. And, you know, no money and, like, all local stuff. But people... We realized that our relationships, like, a lot of the relationships we've developed with people is them coming and feeding us. And being, you know, feeling good about supporting what we're doing by, like, keeping, giving us energy and stuff.
Yeah.
So, people kept showing up with, like, mead and, like, you know, cereal and all stuff. So,
we stream. For reclaimed materials is huge for us. Mm. Yeah, we just finished, like, a chapter of demo work where we took down a two-story house. And there's an opportunity that kind of fell into our laps. After one of the panel discussions we gave at the Saugerties Library, where a guy named, he gave us the opportunity to take down some buildings at the Ashokan Center.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Going to be bulldozed by DEP in September, because apparently it was in a floodplain. So there's these six beautiful buildings that we got, all these windows, beautiful exterior doors. And
how did this come about? Here,
this process kind of this project was a coming together of a few different ideas. So Frank and I have actually been, we went to school together, Skidmore, and we'd been talking for years about, you know, we studied social sciences, and you know, I focused a lot on injustice, you know, kind of oriented, kind of, you know, in college they teach you a lot about a critical view of economics, you know, not too critical, but, you know, neo-Marxist kind of critical view of, you know, poverty and environmental destruction and, you know, the existential psychology, and I learned a lot about how, you know, why the world is, all the problems of the world, basically. So we got an education of eloquently describing the problems of the world, and Frank and I started, you know, talking about realizing that we learned a lot about problems, but there was no guidance of how to address those problems, how to kind of ameliorate them in any way, shape, or form. It really was like this kind of academic, cynical humor almost about how terrible things are, you know, and you know, talking about statistics and theories about why things are bad, and simultaneously this almost regiment of politically correct analysis that people were supposed to abide by of you know race discourse and you know, economic stuff. And so we were both fed up with that, and Frank had a experience in Ghana, I think, that really connected us a lot. You want to tell them about that?
Yeah, well, it's just, I mean, perspective alone. Like, I lived in Ghana for 8 months studying the link between arts and culture. I did, like, a field research project where I was interviewing artists who made tourist art that they sold in the gift shop of the Tor of Elmina Castle, which was one of the main... places that slaves were
the
sent.
Last jumping off point before the Great Crossing.
Yeah, it's kind of pretty much one of the most horrendous places I've ever been. Mm-hmm. In terms of just like its location, so much atrocity took place at one spot, and you know, I learned a lot about kind of a philosophy of art making, and you know, I was kind of on a quest there to understand how the art world is separate from the real world in our society, and how that divorce represents a lot more than just kind of a philosophy of art, but also a philosophy of society. How, you know, we've kind of divorced ourselves from the natural systems that sustain us. In a sense that, you know, real art is infused with culture. There's no separation. There's no gallery scene. There's no, aristocratic kind of jargon that needs to take place. It's something everybody participates in, and it's lived. And when I came back, you know, I realized that, you know, everything that we use and that we consider normal as a day-to-day functioning in the U.S. is entirely based on exploitation. From the toothbrush we use to brush our teeth down to the concepts we think about, the way we organize the world around us is built upon work of other people that we don't see. And Chase and I really connected on talking about what is the work that needs to be done to create a life that isn't based on exploitation, and how much massive changes, not only to the physical infrastructure that need to change in order for us to achieve that, but also how much work in terms of education and facilitating a paradigm shift to kind of change the way we think about our relationship to each other and the world. And that was kind of the genesis of a lot of the tangible things that started to take place.
We really started, like, you know, focusing on that trying to focus on that mental shift. I think that was, you know, I think that was kind of the first thing. Is like, okay, we need to change the way that we think about things. A lot of guilt, you know, a lot of like, all right, how can we change this world? And I really started getting into education, and a guy, John Dewey, I don't know if you ever heard of him, really was someone that really inspired me a lot in terms of his social psychology, his analysis of social psychology, and his educational model of action and of learning through experience. And kind of, we both kind of went our own ways and on our own quests. We stayed in touch, had these, you know, long, intense conversations every few months. And I started working. I worked in college for a while, and I taught abroad and did all that white privilege kid stuff that everyone does, and came back here, actually, is where I grew up, in Saugerties. And I, you know, was like, all right, well, all this stuff, there's all these ideas, there's all this raising awareness, and I don't see any tangible thing. I see all this protests, you know, there's like the Occupy Wall Street stuff, and, you know, there's this global information age that everybody's saying will save us. It's the world brain that H.G. Wells talked about and all this stuff. And, you know, this is going to be it. Everyone has access to information now. It's going to be freedom and all this stuff. But I didn't see anything happening. You know, I saw the experts who are teaching me about all these problems not doing jack, but raising awareness. So it was like, where's the actual action taking place? So a friend, Alex, and I, actually, who is here, we're like, all right, well, let's start by actually doing real things. So what do we need to live a free life and live a life that's not based on exploitation? Because ultimately, the system we live in isn't sustainable, not in the sense of, you know, it's not environmentally friendly, but in the sense that it can't sustain. It won't go on. Infinite growth in a finite world doesn't make sense. There's only so long that you could undermine the foundation of what you stand on. And that foundation is people, you know, the soil, air, obvious stuff. So we're like, all right, well, what can we do? So we started digging a garden in the worst place imaginable. It was all rocks. It was the land that I grew up on. All rocks, and, you know, in West Saugerties. So we had to filter out all the rocks. We started doing that, and as we were digging, we're like, you know, I started looking into housing, you know. So food, hypothetically, you could grow it. You know, that's where food comes from, and whatever else. Get chickens. We got a few chickens that ended up being roosters, but so then we're like, all right, let's start building. So I looked into a underground houses and reading up about that, and there was all these bluestone quarries around here. So we ended up building a few. Another friend of mine came up that I went to school with, and we just invested in this, our time. And I was working part-time to pay for the mortar, but it was a really cheap process. We built a stone underground house, all stone, bluestone walls on this bedrock against like a bluestone cliff. Really cool thing. so that was kind of the first, broke the code, you know, like, oh, wait a second, you could actually do things, you know, you didn't need experts and a bunch of money and all this stuff. So, you know, long story long, we, you know, started endeavoring in all these kind of little projects, and we Frank and I were both on our own paths. I was trying to get Frank to come up here for years because we had that connection, that, you know, intellectual connection, and, you know, I was really trying to, you know, tell him, let's actually get to work, let's do some stuff. And he was pursuing this, the art scene in Austin, and, you know, I was trying to get him to come out here. And finally in January this year, he moved down here, or moved up here, and we really started trying to organize our efforts. And instead of having this little homestead mentality where it's like you work to get your own space, your own land off the grid and self-sufficient, and then if everyone did that, we'd be great. We're like, well, that's not really, doesn't, it's an old model of thinking of like, you have your own land and you can contain yourself within this little bubble, because in reality you can't. You have to rely, you still rely on, it's still based on exploitation, you know, unless you're some kind of superhero in the woods or something like that. So, you know, we started really exploring community. So we actually, through Transition Town in Saugerties, I met a guy there named Larry who made a whole bunch of connections, and I ended up at two people at the same time, actually separate people, told me to talk to Jim, who's, you know, this is his farm, and said, you know, I heard the ideas you have, this guy's really, you know, he's really into that stuff. So I approached Jim and Vivian, and, you know, we got a little group together that was interested in community. A lot of people who were in Transition Town or different, you know, had different experiences with wanting some kind of community, really broad kind of concept. And I proposed to them, like, my ideas about, you know, not basing a community around money. A lot of these, like, intentional communities that exist, they're all about, you know, you buy in with X amount of money and we just pool all our resources and basically just live normal. Maybe there may be some solar panels, but it's basically just, you know, it's not really transforming the foundation of how we live. It's just pooling our resources to make it a little nicer for us. So a little more communal or whatever. So, you know, I was proposing that we set up a system that looks at eliminating money. Because that's usually the linchpin, is, well, there's communities, like you were saying before, where people do the work they love, you know, or live the way they want. Maybe it's being in a nice community, and then they have their, you know, selling hammocks, or their, you know, commodifying essential oils or whatever it is on this. So we, you know, we're trying to kind of create a different system based on work, and kind of figure out, well, what money do we actually need, you know? And everyone's, that's just the final truth. Well, you need some money. People just, oh, you need some money. You need money for materials. You need money for food. You need money for X, Y, and Z. And, you know, really thinking about it, the reality is you can boil it down to just taxes. And there's ways to get around that as well. But right now what we're doing is trying to share the things that cost money, to the point that it's basically insignificant. So people are like, well, you always need to make money. Reality is, there's a surplus of money, which is a silly, we shouldn't even be dealing with that concept anyway, it's all jack. But right now there are people who are going to die with more money than they need. And there's, you know, taxes, you know, on this land aren't that serious. And if you share the land instead of trying to use it to make money to pay the taxes, then the pressure is not on you to work in a way that you don't like. So I proposed this idea, and people were timid, and they said, well, we'll let you try it. So we built this little tiny house here, took apart an old RV.
This one?
Yeah. We took apart an old...
Is it on wheels?
Yeah, it's on wheels.
Oh, nice.
So it's like a home-built RV, technically. Yeah. So that is the way that we try to get around the housing taxes. So that thing is on wheels, it can move, and it's totally off the grid. Mm-hmm. So it has its solar panel, gravity-fed water system, compost toilet. Mm-hmm. And that was the first project here, and that was the first attempt at land sharing, I guess the term people use. So that was our first project. We did a little garlic group project over here where we got a bunch of people together. That first group that said, we like this idea of community, we said, all right, well, let's try this garlic project. And everyone was, you know, like, all right, well, we'll do this much, which will equal this much garlic, and we'll put in this much time and have a schedule. And I was like, let's just try to, you know, we have an abundance of labor here. Let's just try to get all the work done that has to be done. And that's Cassandra.
Hello.
And, you know, let's try to get all the work done that we can get done and see what the product is and share it. And ideally, there should be an abundance of garlic. Turned out there was. So that was kind of our first little attempt at a community garden, and everyone was happy and, you know, felt like, oh, we really did this. There wasn't no money involved.
That was this summer.
That was last fall. Well, that was last fall because you plant the garlic in the fall.
Right.
So, you know, the people were like, all right, it's not based around money. And the way we dealt with the landowners who, you know, are still, they're burnt out on the whole farming process. They wanted to give up on the farming, and, you know, and Jim was totally burnt out on selling vegetables. He hates the whole commercial farming process. So, you know, the way we got around the money thing, I was like, all right, the farm will get a certain amount of garlic that we'll give to them, and the rest will go to us to just share.
This is the Work Show on WGXC-FM. Today we are talking with Chase Randall and Frank O'Leary of the Long Spoon Collective about rejiggering the very notions that underlie our contemporary work ethic. My name is Paul Smart, your host, and we are joined by my bro, Harry Matthews, as well.
Is it all fenced in? Did you put the
fence
up?
Yeah, we put the fence up. Yeah, we got 85 cedar posts we pulled from the woods.
Oh, nice. So where did you get the fencing?
The fencing was all scrapped together, actually. Some stuff was lying around here. Some stuff we got other people had at their places. Some stuff people donated. Then there were a bunch of pea trellises here that weren't being used, so we threw those up and ended up with about a 10-foot fence. So this place is great, you know, it's a beautiful thing. So long story long, we figured out a way, we pooled together, we got some people involved, about six of us got together and pooled the cost of the seeds, which was low. You know, the cost wasn't a lot. You know, so basically the model that we went with is we're trying to eliminate money from the process. But we didn't have the seeds to start, so we made one, what we hope are one-time purchases, one-time investments in seeds, which hopefully if we have good seed saving, we can create our own little seed bank. So we invested in that first purchase, and we opened up to the greater group that we had worked with the garlic and other people, and kind of made this plan. We read a bunch of books, and we tried to see, do an experiment of how much food we could grow basically on this space. So we made a massive garden. We could take a walk down there in a bit, and it worked really well. You know, we busted our ass. We dug lots of beds, and most of the work was done full time by three people and with a lot of volunteers here and there. So we did everything by hand. So we didn't use any tractors. It was done with tractors in the past. So we did everything by hand. We did, double dug bio-intensive beds and lasagna gardens, and we tried all these different methods.
Does the whole idea of being productive that is so inherent with our money world these days, is that a false concept that is, is more seasonal than we think, or the idea of how you match leisure and kind of in internal growth with the actual toil part of subsiding.
That's a great question.
It's like Mark, reminds me of that Mark Boyle thing with the oats, you know.
Right.
There's a guy, Mark Boyle, who wrote this book, Moneyless Man, who did an experiment that turned out to be quite a bit of a lifestyle change, where he went a year without using money and kind of built his own personal infrastructure through relationships and setting himself up in different living situations where and he had, was guided by a few parameters, but lived entirely the year without money and found by the end of the year that it was the way to go, continues to live without money. But he wrote this one section about, you know, he had this exchange where he would work a couple hours on this farm for, I guess,
a pound of oatmeal.
A certain amount of oats.
I think it was 10 hours for a pound of oats.
And he would talk to friends of his who would say, you know, that's absolutely ridiculous. Like, you could work that much hours for like $10 an hour and buy an insane amount of oats comparatively, you know, like you're making nothing. That's a life of extreme poverty. And he said, like, if you think about how much time it takes to grow the oats, to plant the oats, to sow the oats, and to thresh them and to, you know, what do you call that, winnow them, and all the whole processing method of getting the oats, like working 10 hours to get completely processed oats is a fantastic deal, you know? But it's a different lens to look at in terms of productivity. I think because of the exploitive model we've kind of established as the norm through the capitalistic juggernaut that's taken over things, is we have this expectation of things being cheap and things being in abundance, and disposable, and that's only possible because of a massive industrial infrastructure that turns the whole world into an externality. You know, there's this whole notion that, you know, we don't need to include all these aspects of the true cost of that level of production in our budget. We, you know, the destruction of the environment, the destruction of communities and creation of poverty in all different aspects, like all those things don't get factored into the price or of the actual product that ends up in our stores, you know, because how would it make any sense that something, you know, lumber, for example, were you telling me that, Chase? Lumber that, like, it gets cut here, shipped over
to China,
and then shipped back to a distribution unit, and then shipped out again. Same with food, like the amount of places it gets shipped to, it makes no sense that it would be so cheap. It should be insanely expensive, but because of the way the economics of it are laid out, you know, we can enjoy these cheap commodities, and we think of productivity in a completely skewed way. So we have a working theory, which is, you know, I mentioned it briefly before, the more alienated we are from the natural systems that sustain us, such as, you know, the seasonal crops, you know, the sun, the water, the more we're not in touch with how these directly relate to our lives in concrete ways, the more irresponsible we are as consumers, the less we can have a sense of what's real value and what's not, and what work means and what it doesn't. We developed this abstract intelligence that kind of allows us to, you know, pillage the earth the way that we continue to do.
Pillage ourselves too.
Exactly. Well, we're part of the earth. I guess that's a little different lens, but so the work we're doing is to reframe our work, you know, in a lot of ways, because, you know, our productivity is measured in how many people we can feed. And, you know, the model we've been trying to develop here is a surplus model, where we are trying to get our arms around the shape of what it takes to sustain a small group of people completely from the land in terms of meat, in terms of vegetables, you know, and the ratio of the different crops, like grains and starches to, you know, to veggies. It'll, you know, we're doing this biointensive kind of suggestion of 60-30-10. 60% is of our crops are grain, 30% are
root crops,
and then 10% are vegetables. Kind of working our way from a healthy diet into what that actually means in terms of what you put in the soil. Once we kind of get our sense of the shape, we want to produce an abundance more than that. And that surplus we give away for free and allows us to kind of support a lot of different activities that our group does. So productivity to us really is a measure of how much we can give away, because we're kind of focused on a different sense, a different economy here, something closer to a gift economy, where, you know, we're not really concerned about what we have, we're concerned about what we can give. We're not concerned about what we can get, we're concerned about what we can give away.
I think that gets to what you mentioned before we get too far off. I think you were mentioning leisure, like how that fits into the personal development.
Because sometimes you see an experiment or it's people moving in this direction and getting completely caught up in the work.
Right? Yeah.
Where, you know, or others where it becomes a, you know, that kind of common idea of the commune that kind of slips off into its own leisure.
Right. I mean, I think when you said the reason I cut you off is it really brought up something that is, that we're dealing with right now a lot. A lot of the people in, there's a big thing, a big permaculture. You guys familiar with permaculture?
Yeah.
You know, really cool ideas. I mean, awesome, dead on. I mean, it's, you know, kind of stuff that's been, you know, indigenous farming kind of repackaged and sold in workshops. No, there's really great ideas in permaculture, but there's a big movement right now of, it's a kind of a trendy thing, where it's like, you know, hammock farming. Like, it's this idea that if we work, you know, which goes back to the old, like, you know, anarchist commune ideas, which I really like, of, you know, if we focused on need-based economies, we shouldn't have to work so much, which, you know, makes sense. It shouldn't. If we, you know, say this is what we need to get done, this is how much time it will take, and if we all work together, it shouldn't take much time. But there's this, I think this dream of if we, you know, work the magic of the land, we won't have to work that hard. And there's also, and that is also coincidentally that the permaculture culture is also side by side with the yoga workshop, you know, self-discovery, I forgot the word you used, self-learning or self-development kind of culture, which is really looking inward and really focusing on the things that we've neglected, you know, like the work culture of wage slave going, you know, beating yourself up to pay your bills and get things. You know, the response to that has been to not work, basically, and kind of be present and work on your internal development and seeing what really is and being in the present. All beautiful things, but I think something that we see happening, when I say we, I mean, you know, the people who are working, like in this group, the people working full time to try to create this, you know, this different kind, this paradigm shift, we are getting, maybe you would say, caught up in the work.
Is there also a point where you get, you know, that thing where you suddenly feel like, God, I'm working much harder than this person sloughing off? I mean, you know, that...
Not really. I mean, the thing is, the work that we want to do is to... We're trying to get at the root cause of these issues. And they're deep. They're competition, they're... conceptions of private property, their
scarcity.
Yeah, the scarcity model. I think a lot of the old, like a lot of people who are hesitant the people who are kind of naysaying about what we're doing a lot of times are a lot of people who were really into these ideas in the 60s and were like, it didn't work for exactly what you said. Oh, some people don't work hard, some people work too, you know, people, there's always a small group working hard and everyone else is freeloaders, or, you know, it falls apart for whatever, you know. There's a lot of work that has to be done, and the work is not just tilling the soil. The work is recreating an entire infrastructure. Yeah. So we're kind of right now looking at, you know, is it possible to have this leisure? You know, is our generation, do we have that privilege of having leisure? Because in order to have leisure, like, I think it's very important to pay attention to your body. You know, it's critical. To pay attention to your body and to, you know, focus your mind and not get caught up in this, you know, alienated understanding of, you know, work. And but to do that at the expense of, you know, it's like there's a very convenient, comfortable infrastructure in place where we could go, for example, to a workshop, drive a car to Omega and pay whatever amount of money and, you know, listen to someone who flew across the world to give a talk and say, oh, I feel much better about myself now. I needed that. Mm-hmm. Well, you needed that at the expense of other people, you know? So we're kind of really, we're struggling with that.
So it's a leisure that happens while you're weeding. There's a leisure that happens by freeing the mind in a different way.
There is, but it is also important to not work, you know, at times. Yeah. But I think something that we have to figure out that we're working on now is a lot of times we're missing those opportunities and we're not totally in tune because everything is so out of tune. Which, and that's not to say we're distracted by that, but just that there aren't a lot of people really doing the work that needs to be done. And I don't know if that's something I got to get out of my own head and say, you know, I need to move beyond that, but I can't help. Like you said, you pointed to the cars there. We ride our bikes. You know, Frank gave away his car, and even bikes too are part of this industrial process. Ideally, we'd like to walk everywhere, but you then become an outcast. You know, and there's a lot of people doing that too. Like, you know, living in the woods or living homeless or, you know, taking vows of poverty. So we're trying to find that balance of how do we actually, we need to work, get back to what you said at first about work and this concept of work. We need to work prolifically. Like, we need to get a lot of work done. And when I say we need, I mean human beings, you know, or if not our group or whatever it is, there's nobody's really cracking the question of how are we going to grow food. You know, there's one place that grows flour in the Hudson Valley, you know, and we all eat bread. That's a little scary. And the place that does it is across the river, you know, it's not even here. You know, we all rely on the roads.
Are you thinking about doing some sort of milling operation?
That's in the works. Or giving up flour. Do we need flour?
My name is Paul Smart, and this is the August edition of The Work Show on WGXC-FM. We're discussing the contemporary work paradigm and new alternatives to its reliance on money with Frank O'Leary and Chase Randall of the Long Spoon Collective near the banks of the Catterskill, with producer Harry Matthews in on the discussion.
Building houses, we're learning how to build other aspects of off-grid infrastructure. But as far as artistically, it's really the glue, you know, between art and music. That's the culture, and we're trying to figure out how we can create a culture that infuses
every expression of it produces with that kind of mission and that kind of vision, so that people coming into the mix or interacting with us can have something they can grasp onto other than just this philosophical agenda, or like, you know, this kind of, like you said, toil in the field, which it hardly is. I mean, if you look behind you, it's one of the most lush, beautiful gardens I've ever seen in my life. It's a pleasure to work in there. But, you know, the art side of things, we're still trying to figure it out. Like, you know, is traditional painting, you know, photography, you got to use a camera. We're struggling with that. Like, we're trying to figure out how to document everything we're doing. And it doesn't feel right to carry this big, you know, Canon or Nikon around, even a small one around, or a smartphone into the garden. You know, it just doesn't feel right, because it isn't right. You know, a lot of times people who are really radical, which I consider myself quite radical, they alienate everybody. They don't bring anyone along with them. You know, they're totally on their own. If you live completely by your principles, I think a lot of times I could sacrifice the whole mission. So what we're trying to do is...
Well, ideologues are typically, you know, very rigid.
Right. But, you know, it's tricky because...
Well, it's one thing to be rigid with yourself. It's another thing to impose your ideology on somebody else with the same rigidity
right.
that you do yourself.
But it's... I mean, the word rigid is... We should be flexible. You know, the word rigid is a loaded word, I think. You know, I think we should be disciplined.
All words are loaded.
Yeah, they are. You're right. But it's tricky because right now our actions are resulting in exploitation of people, even the killing of people, you know. Money, it's the use of money is tied to... If you want to end all... injustice quickly, not all, you know, it's obviously not all injustice, but a lot of the injustice that we, you know, analyze critically, stop using money. You know, war is economically motivated, you know, exploitation of the soil, cutting down the rainforest, killing animals, poisoning the water. It's all, if they weren't getting a paycheck, they wouldn't be doing that crap. So if my own family and people I care about are participating in that, or I'm doing that, it's hard not to impose that. You know, it's hard not to try to say we shouldn't be doing that. If I was sitting here stepping on someone's face while we were talking, I assume that you would say don't do that, you know. But if you said that and the person wasn't here, then I could say, look man, you're making me uncomfortable, you know, you're too radical. So it's a kind of...
Well, here's another does it, you know, the idea of you know, a community of this sort, at that point where you, children come into it, or somebody starts to grow older, does that change the dynamic then? Or is that something that one has, that the community has to mature towards?
I think,
or is that a...
I think we need to, like... I'm not sure if we really explained exactly... I think community is another loaded word.
Yeah.
I think we think of community a lot of times as... in terms of these kind of projects, as a space where there is, within those lines, yeah. is the community. So right now, our community, the Long Spoon Collective, consists of, you know, people over the age of 60, a lot of them, if not a majority, people in their late 20s, people in their, you know, early, you know, late 30s, early 40s. So we run, the community is already, has all those elements. But community to me is not saying this is the place that we're going to make a community. It means locking people, creating mutually beneficial relationships between people that are already in physical proximity to each other. So it's not about creating a space and saying, here are the rules of this community, and then we all like it, but then people get old and they change their minds, so it falls apart, and the kids don't want to carry on. Because that, you know, that doesn't make sense. We need to figure out how to work together. You know, we're not talking about buying up land and making these utopian places. We're talking about people have land already. They have places they should be growing gardens. They already are paying taxes on things. So we should just say, look, you're not using these resources for your benefit or for the benefit of anyone in the world. So how about we grow a garden here and we make a house that's not taxable, so somebody, some young person who's working in the service industry to pay $800-$900 of rent in Brooklyn to go to the bar scene twice a week, and instead let's take those people and put them in a house so that they can work on growing food, not using oil, and helping you as you age, and connect you into this community of, you know, of a culturally rich community that's not based on money. I think the main thing we're trying to teach or to show by example is that if we share, there's an abundance. You know, if we work together, which
that's
sounds
the story of the long spoon,
right?
You know, the whole nature of, you know, the parable, the long spoon parable, like, you know, that parable.
Yeah, sure.
I do, but we did. This is a good time to reiterate it.
So I think the original, I have no idea what the original is, but from what I've heard, the original is a rabbi in his sleep is visited by an angel who gives him the option to see heaven or hell. And he said, okay, so she escorts him up to, or down to hell first. And hell is this massive banquet table filled with the most amazing food you can imagine. But everyone sitting around it is emaciated and starving because they have these long spoons attached to their arms that are too long for them to get the food into their mouths. So they're tortured by just the sight of this beautiful, amazing food that they can't eat. So he goes up to hell with the, he goes up to heaven with the angel, and it's the same exact scenario. Massive banquet table filled with all this delicious food, but everyone sitting around it is jolly and full, having a good time because they're reaching across the table with long spoons attached to their arms and feeding each other. So it's kind of this, the nature of our group is thinking about how we have all the resources we need if we could learn how to share them. If we can learn how to reach across the table and take care of each other, we'll all be fed.
This has been The Work Show on WGXC Hands On Radio out of Acre, Catskill, and Hudson, New York. We have been talking with Chase Randall and Frank X. O'Leary of the Long Spoon Collective over a wood fire cooked breakfast in their fields near the Catterskill Creek. Music today was by Cam Heat and the Brooklyn-based Afrobeat phenomenon, Antibalas Afrobeat Orchestra, doing Che Che Cole Makossa, Battle of the Species, Sisi Buede, and Who Is This America? My name is Paul Smart, and we look forward to engaging you again next month. Until then, keep on working. America!
Individualism. America do this, America do that, America go here, America go there. That is what them they say. In the streets of New York, in the cafes of Europe, on the streets of Lagos, of New York, in the cafes of Europe, on the roads of Lagos, everybody they talk, me have questions, oh dear, I get confused, who is this America, can speak up today,
who is this America, can speak up today,
is it you, or me, or the next brother we had, oh,
who is this America,
them speak up like my next door neighbor. Who is America?
Who is America?
Them
speak up
today. But they can't be every brother. Every brother can't be him.
Who is America?
Them
speak up today.
Is it Ronald McDonald in him Mickey house? Or just be him eating burger? Oh. Watching Nike, him who watching TV, oh, I grow confused, oh, I must ask again, who is this America, let's speak up today, tell me,
who is this America, let's speak up today,
is it indigenous America, one that first come live here, is him original America, oh, live for peace and harmony, oh. Before immigration started, before immigration started, oh. Here comes the Spanish
immigrant.
Here comes the Dutchman
immigrant.
Here comes the English
immigrant.
Here comes the Frenchman
immigrant.
Yeah. Immigrants are fooled,
immigrant.
Here comes the Spanish
immigrant.
Here comes the Dutchman
immigrant.
Here comes the English
immigrant.
Here comes the Frenchman. Here comes the pilgrim, with the alien, with no paper, with
immigrant.
No green card. The good day,
oh.
Come with smallpox, come with rifles, come with land rights, then come with prison too. Then be first to say, this is America. I go America now.
but I must ask again. I grow confused. Who is America? Let's speak up today.
Who is America? Let's speak up today.
Hey, Scott, who is America? Let's speak up today.
Who is America? Let's speak up today.
Listen, listen. Is it the black man who stole it from Africa? Oh, whipped and whipped into slavery. Oh, fight and fight for freedom. Just right in the back of us and bring us culture, America. And bring us music too, America. Whoa. Him fight and him die, now he can sit where him like. But him still not the drive this bus. It's him, America, then speak up today. Listen, is it the slave master? Plantation owner, yes. Cook those Klansman, a man with a whip. Factory owner, him go say loud and proud. Him go say white is America. Him go say oh, him na America. Oh, I must ask again, cause I grow more and more and more and more confused. Oh, who is America? Let's speak up today. Oh, 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 oh,
who is America?
Is he company
walker?
Or CEO? Is he soldier captain? Or soldier family? Is he liberal organizer? Or police strike breaker? Is he drunkard on the street? Tell me. Or is he drunkard in the White House? Oh, or a tycoon? Oh, a green party voter? Or undercover police? Or a school teacher? CIA? IRS? DEA? NBC? CNN? FCC? NRA? FBI? INS? ATD, ATF, EPA, SEC, NFL, NBC, NBA, WB, BBR, HMO, HUD, AAA, GSAER, BTA.
Who is America?
Let's speak up to you. The next part away, I know. Whoa.
Who is America? Let's speak up today.
Let's speak up like my next door neighbor. Whoa. Ooh, yeah.
Who is America? Let's speak up today.
Steal their money, oh. One flag is not big for this many people.
Who is America? Let's speak up today.
This is no one community, no one family, oh.
Who is America? Let's speak up today.
No people united. What is united in a state of confusion? No pluribus uno, no pluribus uno.
Ah!